In this episode of Doctor Who Podshock, the legendary first ever Doctor Who director, Waris Hussein, talks about Doctor Who beginnings and compares it to present day. Police sirens at about 28 minutes into the show, in case you are driving. Matt Smith doing American accents in Doctor Who, The Runaway Train. All that and more in this episode of Doctor Who Podshock. The following is a production of Art Trap Productions, brought to you by the Gallifreyan Embassy and has been made possible by supporting subscribers and donations from listeners like you. This episode brought to you by Doctor Who Podshock supporting subscribers. Go to arttrap.com/podshocksupporter to become a supporting subscriber. Support the show and get extra content as well. This episode also brought to you by Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy. Check out their website at dlayer.net. That's D as in dragon, lair.net. This episode also brought to you by audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at audiblepodcast.com/arttrap. Over 75,000 titles to choose from for your iPod or MP3 player.
Live from the roof of the world, this is Doctor Who Podshock. Doctor Who Podshock.
Okay, well, let's do it
now.
Whatever it is, if it's valuable, send it to us.
For the best in all things Doctor Who, it's Doctor Who Podshock, the podcast all about Doctor Who, the longest-running science fiction television program, with Louis Trapani.
Hello.
Ken Deep.
Hello.
James Norton.
Hello.
News.
Fabulous.
Reviews.
Oh, no.
And fan mail for James.
40,000.
Doctor Who Podshock, from the Gallifreyan Embassy.
You know, that guy James was really cool. Oh, yeah, we blew that.
I'm the Doctor, and who are you? And who are you?
The Gallifreyan Embassy in its 25th year presents Doctor Who Podshock.
Episode 218.
My name is Ken Deep, alongside Mr. Louis Trepanning.
Hey, hello.
And on the West Coast, helping us out today is Amy Krell and Joshua Lou Friedman, our West Coast correspondents.
Hello.
Hello.
We have a very special episode today as we are joined, thanks to Amy and Josh's help, by the legendary director of An Unearthly Child, none other than Mr. Waris Hussein.
Yay.
Hi. Hello.
Welcome to Doctor Who Podshock. First, I have to say, on behalf of Doctor Who fans everywhere, thank you. Thank you for being the man who directed the very first episode of Doctor Who.
Yeah, it wasn't just thank you for being on our show. It was thank you.
Okay, this is a very interesting situation for me because when I was first involved on this project, nobody knew what the hell we were doing. It was conceived by the most fantastic head of drama at that time at the BBC, a man called Sidney Newman. And Sidney had this idea of doing a show which would be entertaining as well as educating for kids. It was meant to be a kids show. So then the whole point was that the format would be that we would go from the present, then we'd go into the past, and then we'd go into fantasy, depending. But there would be an educational edge to it. That format, I think, is still being observed, but obviously on a much more elaborate level. Mm-hmm. However, when we started, nobody at the BBC, other than Sydney, and a wonderful producer, brought in Verity Lambert. She used to be a PA at ABC Television, which was the drama station for some very high quality dramas, and she was a PA on that. Anyway, she was brought in as a producer, and we two kids, mm-hmm. and I say kids, were put into a situation where neither of us knew what we were dealing with. And it was Sydney's idea to have a telephone box, that a police box that became the interior of a vast ship. And I mean, it's all very well, but in the days we were shooting this, because the BBC didn't know what it had, we were put into the oldest studio you could find, demolished now, thank goodness, but in those days existed, and with the oldest equipment you could have. So we weren't in the glamorous television center where everybody was doing their thing. We were put into this sort of out-of-the-way place, like a kind of warehouse, and with, I think, a budget, which in those days, possibly if you multiply, meant more than it does now, but it was £2,000 an episode. The first scripts I had were to do with creating fire amongst a lot of hairy people. Now, how do you do dialogue with
grunting
people's names like Og and Og? And I, as a young director who had aspirations to doing dramatic stuff, was faced with this. And to be honest with you, the reason I was given the task was because no one else wanted to do it. And I was a contract person.
Wasn't there a director before you that didn't get along with Verity?
Well, he was kind of, he left it because he not only didn't get along with her, but he didn't get along with the project, and he felt deeply insulted to be asked. So I found, anyway, so there was me under contract. I'd been attached to a he's got it all.
Yeah.
I don't think Ashby, he's got it. He's done
by the way, just go ahead, Josh.
Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
Compact was a daytime soap opera that used to go twice a week. And once, it was set in a women's magazine.
Yeah.
And I was attached to it as a trainee. And then I got my first shot at doing Compact. And guess who my designer was in those days? Ridley Scott.
Yeah,
I was going to say Ridley Scott.
So Ridley and I became pals then. I haven't had a movie from him since, but the fact is he does know who I am. Anyway, the point was when he came onto my episode, it involved a fashion show, which was very unusual because most of the sets were set in rooms at this women's magazine, which meant awful little sets with filing cabinets. In those days, because you needed to give them some business to do, the characters always went to a filing cabinet to get some movement in the set. I mean, you know. Anyway, going back to Doctor Who, none of those equipments were available to us. I'll never forget the first episode, and we had a cameraman. First of all, these cameras were as large as the men, if not bigger, and the Daleks were even dwarfed by them. And I was very ambitious because I wanted to do all these fantastic camera movements. Don't forget, in those days, there was no such thing as Steadicam or anything. So when you wanted to track across somewhere, you know, the poor guy got a back. I mean, he almost wrenched his back doing the tracks. And there was no one to help him, and they were all cables. Because again, we're shooting 2 to 3 cameras simultaneously. That's another art in itself, which I don't think exists anymore. We were trained to work with cables and how to attach them to the outlets so that one cable wouldn't knit across the other and that kind of thing. Anyway, so we did this episode, which involved not only fog-laden London in this warehouse, you know, the mystery of discovering the TARDIS, and then the mystery of discovering who this young girl is, and anyway, the pilot, and by the way, we didn't do pilots in those days, but Sydney decided that he'd give us the first chance. Well, it was a shambles. Things happened that you just wouldn't want to even talk about, and especially trying to get in. When you open the door of the phone box and then go into the interior, you had to cut tape. In those days, you were rationed to, I think, four edits of tape. Unless somebody died on set or said some unmentionable words. So anyway, I just couldn't figure out how to do this. We even opened the door. Anyway, it was not a good thing. And Sydney watched the pilot, took Verity and me out to dinner, and said, you know, by rights, I should be firing both of you. But I'm going to give you a second opportunity. Now, what are you going to do to improve this? And I said, well, Sydney, you know, you've got to give us a break here. Not only do we have this problem of technical stuff, which we don't have facilities for, but secondly, you know, give me some idea of why I am lumbered with this situation with a budget that I have to then ask actors when they come in, because we cannot afford to put too much hair on them, are you hairy? And have open your shirt out, which makes me very suspect.
That's an interesting casting call.
So anyway, so we cast this willy-nilly with extras who were hairy and women who, obviously, they wore more skins. But anyway, somehow the discovery of fire was the first 4 episodes. But you know what's interesting now in retrospect? there was something about this, because of, I remember there was a big epic movie made after that called A Quest for Fire.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
oh,
it was
yeah.
very, very expensive, you know?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of stuff went on into that movie. But we didn't have that sort of facility. And the only facility we had was this big fight scene, which we were allowed to film on single cameras as Telecine and run it into the tape, which was the fight scene between the hero hairy guy and the villain hairy guy. And at the end of it, the villain gets killed by the hero taking a huge rock and bringing it down on the head of the villain. Now, it's funny, you can't show that, obviously, for TV children, but I wanted, it's very funny, Verity and I had a terrible fight in the control room because I wanted to make a sound effect of the skull. We had a guy standing by the microphone with a hammer and a cabbage. So he hit the cabbage with the crunch, and Verity Lambert said, "You cannot use that sound." I said, hey, wait a minute. We're not seeing anything. We're just getting a sound. Mm-hmm. She said, "You're not going to use it." And I said, "Yes, I am." And she said, "You're not going to use it." And I said, "Verity, I am the director." And she said, "You are the director. I am the producer." And I said, "Fine, I'll walk."
Yeah.
She said, "You walk, Warris, and you'll never work in this town again." So anyway, we resolved it because there was no sound effect. Obviously, I wasn't going to be fired like that, but we had a very affectionate relationship all our lives, and she was very instrumental in my later career, so I give her full marks, and she was a great producer and a good friend. Anyway, that was how Doctor Who started. Then the casting, William Hartnell was very well known in movies
in general.
He was doing a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Brighton Rock and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, the films that Richard Attenborough used to be in and things like that. Brian Forbes used to direct those kind of movies. Well, William Hartnell, there were various actors being considered, and Verity thought of him, and we went to have lunch with him. It's very funny. He just couldn't believe he was being offered this. He'd really come for an expensive lunch. And at the end of the lunch, he said, "Why would I involve myself in something like this?" And we said, "Well, because you're so perfect for it." You know, we're crawling all over him, telling him how wonderful he is. And he said, "I don't need it." And so Verity said, "Now, William, please, just think about this, Bill. We are going to have to go away. Let's not make any decisions, and maybe we can have another lunch."
Actor's food.
Actors
there you go.
Getting food. That's so a way to get an actor, yeah.
So we had a second lunch. And he came over, and this time, but you know what was even more funny? William, Bill, belonged to the old world. I mean, really, and you got the marks for that. He was very conservative in his thinking. He still believed in the British Empire. Mm-hmm. And here he had this young Indian with a very English accent. Couldn't quite make head or tail of me. And it got to the point where, when we were rehearsing, the first few days was all questions. Like, why am I moving from here to there? Mm-hmm. Or, are you sure that this is the right way to do it? And I finally got around him by saying, "William, you know what? If you walk over there, there's no set.
Yeah.
I'm quite happy to build one, but it's expensive, and maybe you'll have to come out of your salary." I mean, I was joking, of course. Yeah. But he saw the joke. And he said, okay, where does the set end? Because we used to have to rehearse with all these taped floors.
Yeah.
Right,
and
you're
always
right.
Three-sided because, you know, one is open for the three cameras and the rooms and whatever. So anyway, we got to go on, and actually we got on incredibly well. He was cranky, as he is in real, as he was in the character.
Yeah.
But what was fascinating about Doctor Who, which I now find has sort of, in his various incarnations, he's become more and more charming and much more like, you know, and the younger he gets, the more sexy it becomes. But the fact was, the initial concept was a man that you could not quite fix on. He looked old, but was he old and was he actually dangerous? Because there were times when we wanted to put him in jeopardy, mm-hmm. and instead of saving everybody as a hero would, there were times when he was willing to sacrifice his companions. Sure. Now, that's kind of subtle. Yeah. It's a very difficult way, edge, but we gave it to him because there's a scene where they're running through the forest, which, by the way, again, was created in Studio D, Lime Grove, with whatever trees and shrubbery we could have. But it actually wasn't a bad set. Anyway, he actually, there's a point where he picks up a rock where he's about to kill one of the girl companions, you know, one of the hairy girls is running with him, and she falls and gets wounded or something and might be hazarding their escape. So he's prepared to take a rock up. And I think it's William Russell said, "Doctor, what do you think you're doing?" And that's great, isn't it? Now, that element has got lost, I think.
There was an attempt to try to bring that back with the Sixth Doctor, Colin Baker, when after his regeneration, you know, he started strangling Perry, and that was...
That's true. They did bring him back that. But, you know, even then, that was Colin Baker. But you know what? Tom Baker had that element, too, of insanity in him. Yes. But the fact is, though, that I wish that there'd be more Jeopardy involved. I wish that there... Now, for instance, Matt Smith, who was very good, I think, in his own way, make him into a sort of eccentric academic. I wish there was a little bit more unpredictability, so that his companion said, unless he's being somewhat weirdized by thing, his nature is not to be complex in that area. But it's something that happens. I'm simply observing what it started off as. And obviously over the years, he becomes something else. So it's not a complaint I'm making. I'm just making an observation. Sure. Because I was so involved in that particular area. I must tell you that at the time that this show was recorded, nobody knew what they had. The Daleks had yet to come. And on the first night of our transmission, President Kennedy got killed. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you can imagine what that meant. Then they did transmit it later. I think it was the following day, was it? I can't remember. Anyway, they did show it. Yeah. And then it started to get a kind of impetus. Then the Daleks, which obviously I wasn't involved with. But then I did an episode, which was educational as well as full of adventure, which was about Marco Polo.
Yeah.
And the journey of Marco Polo through Cathay, which was China, to the Imperial Court of China. Now, in Studio D Lime Grove, I assure you, to do anything like that, I mean, even Spielberg could have learned a thing or two about how we managed to shoot that. But the fact is, by that time, it had got enough heat to get the budget up.
Yeah.
And you know what is so regretful is that entire 7 hours has got lost.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's got lost is like, if anyone can find it, they're going to make a fortune.
Yeah.
Because I listened to the audio of that today. Yes. They've released, they have the soundtrack to it.
Yes, so yes.
And they link it with narration. William Russell provides some narration, which, first off, is wonderful. It's just really well handled. Particularly, you're saying that the resources were so limited. So the dialogue and the little moments have to sell you on the fact that you're in the Gobi Desert or you're traveling with Marco Polo.
Yes. And we had blizzards to deal with. And believe me, in those days, with a wind machine... And the only way you could do a visual blizzard was to electronically interfere with the image so that it would get that kind of blurry. I mean, those were the sort of... We were having to be, in many ways, inventive.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, I had all the stills from it, which in those days, there was no video anyway, I mean, privately. And I used to commission a guy called John Cura, who used to photograph... frame by frame, the images of the show. So I used to get the whole lot into my books. And I have all of them. Now what's happened is they've been using these stills to compile it into a DVD with stills and dialogue that's already existing.
Like telesnaps.
So telesnaps, exactly.
Yeah.
So we've got that. However, it's in black and white. But the production designer took his own photographs of the set. And I tell you, the colors... If it had ever been able to be colored, it is fantastic. And the depth of those setups, the different tents that the scenes, the way stations that were created, the inventiveness of these designers who were able to move something around. Mm-hmm. I learned so much from this show in my future directings, you know, because there's a tendency for designers to go to town and put everything, and then half the time, the director doesn't even shoot some of it. It's just a waste of money. He's aiming in that direction, and all the stuff back there is not shown unless he chooses to do that. And there were times when I would say, look, guys, we can't afford to show the whole of the palace.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to be able to look back that way. Give me everything you've got, and I promise not to aim off it. So we'd put all the action, and the designers would then put everything they, I mean, especially with the high, when you go to the Imperial Court of China, they wanted to put in all sorts of expensive furniture and stuff. Mm-hmm. But when you look at it, mm-hmm. it looks like $1 million because you haven't moved left or right knowing that it's just bare walls.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the art of making that kind of film. And I've learned that since, even when it comes to one camera stuff, mm-hmm. because very rarely do you see a 360-degree area of shooting in any movie, unless you choose to. And then you actually set it up and say, right, I want to see the whole set. But most of the time, a lot of the stuff that is put up by designers, and they get so frustrated.
Yeah.
They say, I put all that there, and nobody saw it. I said, well,
you should have listened to me when I was blocking it.
I never talked about it.
Yeah.
But in pre-planning, you have to do that.
Prep is everything.
I do have a question about that, because obviously, you know, Josh and I are in production, and we know about this stuff, and the way pilots are shot here. How much involvement did you have, you know, in casting? You did have some input in casting the rest of the roles and in the look of the show, mm-hmm. Because obviously you came in so early, but you weren't first in. Was that Verity Lambert? Was it the executive producer? Was it you? What involvement did everybody have in that, in establishing certain things in the show?
I think I would give I would claim that for Verity and myself. First of all, the designer, again, brought on reluctantly.
Yeah.
He had a limited amount of money, and what's so extraordinary is that he made that hexagonal set, which was the interior of the TARDIS, with two sets of walls with these circles in them. Nobody quite knew what, but that was it. And he had this this hexagonal control thing. And basically, he said, that's all I can give you, Waris, because I have no money.
But that became iconography.
It's become, the hexagonal has become iconographic, absolutely.
Yeah.
But that started off with no money. So, but I said, look, we have to, the TARDIS interior, because of black and white,
mm-hmm.
Let's make everything white, the floor, everything, because then the characters stand out against it. And if you notice, the girl is wearing dark clothes, and he's wearing Victorian dark clothes, so they stand out against the white, and the white tends to go into infinity, even though, you know, it's not the end. You know what I mean? I guess I was heavily influenced by these sort of movies that I used to go and see in the 60s. There were a lot of that white and black stuff going on.
Alphaville.
Yes.
Exactly.
So it's very much of the part. Also, you know, the point is that I didn't actually, I wanted to escape. I didn't want to do the second. After the Marco Polo, I said to Verity, please do not ask me to do any more of these, because I want to do serious drama. And she, of course, what was so funny was I got my serious drama. It was going to be a thriller written originally for television, for the BBC, by Patricia Highsmith.
Wow.
And I even met with her, and it was all to do with a husband trying to kill his wife. And I was so thrilled. And then suddenly, because Verity and I got on so well, she was transferred to another show, a pilot. It was called it was about a family that moves out of London and goes to a small town, and it's about them resettling themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly I'm summoned and told, you're not going to do the drama. Verity wants you for the pilot. And pilots here, if they're successful, you end up being very rich. Over there, forget it. If you're a trainee contract director, that doesn't mean a thing. So I said, I'm not going to do it. She said, so the head of drama, not Sydney, but his deputy called me, and he was a naval type.
Yeah.
Smoked
Donald
pipe.
Wilson.
Donald Wilson.
Sorry.
See, he knows it all.
He's very good. I'm impressed.
We do our
Donald Wilson, pipe.
Mm-hmm.
Navy blazer,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome aboard, you know, piping you on board. And he summons me to his office, and in between sucking on his pipe, he says to me, Warris, you do realize the ramifications of this. You have to do it. And I said, I will not do it. I've done my apprenticeship. Are you saying that therefore you will be walking from here and never coming back, sort of thing? Well, of course, I couldn't afford to do any of that.
Yeah.
So I ended up doing, it was called The Newcomers. That was a series. And I was so angry because the whole Patricia Highsmith thing didn't happen. Can you imagine having that on your CV?
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was one of many experiences I've had since of shows I never got to make.
CV is resume for all of us here in America.
Yeah, it translates. Thank you.
I've learned that myself recently, actually.
Oh, thank you. You see, there we are. We call things like you get the trunk of a car, we call it the boot.
Oh, yeah. Well, just on set instead of last looks, it's checks and what have you, you know. But okay. Go on, by all means.
So what else? Anyway, back to Doctor Who. Well, so that was my experience. And the funny thing is, there was a reunion recently for the Marco Polo, and it was a convention in Cardiff to which I went, and I've suddenly found myself. You know, it's very strange. I feel like Rip Van Winkle. I got forgotten. I mean, Doctor Who was right. I did it, and that was it. Move on. Suddenly, it's become this big thing. Not suddenly, but you know what I mean. It's become this iconic thing, and suddenly I've been resurrected.
Yeah, it never forgot you.
Yes, it never forgot you.
Well, I'm happy to hear this, but I thought I'd definitely be. I'll tell you a story. There was a BBC celebration for the 25th anniversary, and at the television center, nobody told me. So I decided to invite myself.
I crashed it.
I entered through the gates, and the security said, well, I said, look, I forgot my invitation, but believe me, I'm involved. So I got in, and I got to the sixth floor where there was this whole thing going on, and the guy at the door said, can I help you? And I said, yes. I said, look, without me, this wouldn't be happening. And so I marched in there, and everybody's praised, you know, patting themselves on the back. And in all fairness, when I arrived, I said, listen, and they did give me the full treatment. And then, but that was 25 years down the line. So they'd forgotten to even think of me. Now, there have been many directors since. So, you know, they're going to say, well, so what the hell? Why are you so important? You did the first one. Well, I feel that it's like my baby.
Sure.
I gave birth to this thing. And whoever else took it on, it's not the point. The point is that I was at its inception, and I feel very proud of that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Others have done better work on it. They've had more money to play with. The directors now, I mean, from what I gather, the latest episodes with all their special effects are up to £1 million. So, I would love to go back there, but that's not on the cards, or certainly hasn't been. And there's a whole new generation anyway. But the fact is that on that front alone, I claim my place, but not without some degree of regret that I'm not doing it now. Because I'd quite like to do it.
Yeah. You seem very familiar with what's going on, because you mentioned about Matt Smith and your impression of him. So this is something, and you mentioned Tom Baker as well. So Doctor Who has remained with you, and I think there might have been an impression, being that you were there at the beginning, but not since, that perhaps you've gone on to some other things, and like many professional people, just moved on with their career. But it seems to have stayed in your heart a bit.
Oh, absolutely it has. But, I mean, it's not, first of all, it's a kind of nostalgia thing. I haven't stayed with it all the time. I mean, if you were to ask me about some of the intervening episodes with other doctors, I wouldn't know anything about them. I wouldn't know what so-and-so was. Yeah. You know, there are other. But Tom Baker was sort of iconic, as was David Tennant, and now Matt Smith.
Yeah.
But in between, there were certain, I think, Doctor Who's that didn't quite work. And when it wound down originally, you know, with it was sort of written off, by that time it has become very tired and not very inventive, up to my mind. And I was working in the States and I was making movies and stuff. Mm-hmm. But obviously it stuck with me to the point that I was always... Now, the Matt Smith thing I really was fascinated by, because I wanted to know what would happen after David Tennant.
He was a tough act to follow.
Very tough. stuff, but I think he's done incredibly well because he's been given a whole different approach. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Moffat, by the way, is a very good writer, mm-hmm. and he's a plus man. I thought that with Russell T, who obviously revived it, there was a tendency by towards the middle and end to indulge. Mm-hmm. And David Tennant was given leeway to just do whatever he is good at, mm-hmm. you know, the expense of the character. You know, Matt Smith, even though that's another concept, is very much in the saddle with that particular. And it's very ingenious to have made his companion a nubile, sexy girl, and not just screaming at the right moments, but the tension that might exist between him and her. With David Tennant, there was that element too with Billy Piper, but it was not explored. In this, it's more ambivalent. I think one of the best episodes that's happened recently was the one about Van Gogh, actually.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Richard Curtis wrote a brilliant script because it showed humanity, it showed compassion, and also taught kids about Van Gogh, who would know nothing about him.
Sure.
That's what the intention of this show originally was.
With Marco Polo, per se, and
In general. But that got lost sometimes. You know, when they did things like Queen Victoria with suddenly a big something appeared. It didn't get the humanity of a woman who was a widow. I mean, she's a queen. They had her running around the corridors. Mm-hmm. Well, in Van Gogh, even that was a monster. But the ingenious ways in which they incorporated it, and the fact that the man was on the edge and was actually about to do himself in, and the girl knows who he is, mm-hmm. and he dedicates his painting to her, I found that fabulous.
Even inspires him. Very moving.
Yeah. And that's, I think, Stephen Moffat. Because Stephen has a compassion and a humanity that I like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I hope that that'll continue into the future.
Well, it's doing so incredibly well. I mean, that's very heartening because obviously when we came up with this, you know, we were mocked, but, it was
What did you come up with?
Well, I mean, when we were coming up with the show, when we were watching it when we were kids it was sort of a very subculture-y thing, and now it's very popular.
It was very culty.
Where is it shown here in the States?
BBC America airs it usually like a couple weeks after.
Oh, does it?
And it was sci-fi.
It was on the sci-fi channel as well.
It's got a big following now, hasn't it?
It's BBC America's highest rated show.
Yeah, even the spin-offs, Torchwood, is just huge.
Yeah, Torchwood is a whole different ballpark, as we know. I believe they're going to make some here now.
Yeah they are stars here in the States.
Stars have been taken up.
Yeah.
I believe Russell T's here now.
Russell T and Julie Gardner are...
They're both here.
BBC Worldwide America.
And Jane Tranter is involved.
She's here too, mm-hmm. yeah.
Jane Tranter was head of drama at the time that I was sort of... I'll tell you another story. We paid a tribute to Verity when she passed away, and BBC did a fabulous tribute. And Jane Tranter had never met with me at the tribute. They had compiled a film of all of us talking heads, you know, about mm-hmm. Verity. And I was surprised to show... I went and talked a bit like this on camera.
Yeah.
But suddenly I found myself appearing quite a lot, and I thought, that's interesting, because some people just came for, like, 4 seconds, 5 seconds or whatever. And Jane Tranter stood up at the end and said, I'm very happy to welcome a lot of the people involved. And she mentioned my name, and that was fine, but I'd never met her. So at the end of this... And we were all standing around having drinks, and I pushed my way through. And I went and introduced myself to her to say, thank you for mentioning me. And she went, geez, she said, how old were you when you directed Doctor Who? And I said, 12.
Yeah. That's kind of how I was walked in. I'm like, really? You look very, we almost look the same age. So you look very young,
Well,
sir,
that's kind of... the portrait's up in the attic.
There you go.
But the fact is... The funny thing is, the moment she clocked me on this basis, I thought, right, you know, all this prejudice about anybody over 35 can't do it. So I immediately sent her a project. And funnily enough, she was interested. It almost got there, and then she left. And that was the end of it. So this is what happens in this business, isn't it? And the new guy who came in, he wiped the stables clean. You know, they don't ever want to follow up on anybody else.
No.
So that particular project, but it almost, she was suddenly said, okay, my agent called me out and said, listen, I've got through to Jane and she wants this and that and a bit more information. And I said, oh my God, this is fantastic. She hasn't said, oh, we don't want Morris or whatever. But it didn't happen because she left.
They're the smartest executives we've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the smartest people we've ever met. They're just really? Astonishing. Yeah, I mean, particularly for America, too, where people don't read things before you go into a meeting.
Uh-huh.
You know, we go in and they've read the script. It's just so big shout out to how great those people are.
Yes. So we're now here. Are you involved with them at all in any of the things they're doing? Or?
We could only wish, but... Yeah.
Why? Why can't you?
Oh, well, you know, we're trying. We're trying very hard.
Yes.
Was that Drama Queen the name of the special that they did on Verity?
The name of the special?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I remember...
It sounds impossible. Yeah.
Right after she passed away, they did a special on it. A retrospective on
it. That was on Channel 4 or wherever. But no, this was a special evening.
Oh, okay.
That was dedicated to her by the BBC, which I think was a very good thing to do. Because she'd done so much in her life, not just for the BBC. I mean, she got me involved. I mean, she had such an incredible eye and ear for, talent.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, she appreciated me. There was a time when I had done a very bad experience on a show. Which involved two major names in Hollywood. And I don't know whether we should talk about that, but mm-hmm. anyway, it was a disaster. And I really thought that was the end of my career. And actually, what happened was I happened to be in L.A. with a friend who had said, come over and just try and get rid of your whole sense of disaster. And she tracked me down. Verity tracked me down.
Yeah.
And she said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm hiding. She said, no, you're not. She said, you're going to come back here because I'm going to do a series about the suffragettes called Shoulder to Shoulder. And that's how I went back into the saddle.
Yeah.
And she resurrected my career in a way. Because over here, suddenly everything went quiet. Oh, God, this guy, you know, the most terrible show. And, you know, that's the way things are. If it's so bad, it was critically badly panned. So that started the upward. And then what she was responsible for was to get me one of the top series ever. And that was about the abdication of called Edward and Mrs. Simpson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there. I won an Emmy for that, and I won a BAFTA for it. So... You know what I mean?
You never know. You're never too down. You can always
exactly.
Always
so,
and waves.
So that's why I'm still here.
But it's also, you know, it's a testament to her and her belief in talent.
Yes.
And she didn't forget things like that. I'm on record as saying that she was a huge influence. I think on a lot of people, more people than I think anybody would ever realize, that I look to someone like Verity as someone who, and you as well, when you look at these the start of this show, the show that we all love in Doctor Who, what you did for the resources that you were given, the amount of creativity that had to be poured into it in order to pull this off. And mm-hmm. that's inspirational. And I always thought, geez, if I could only pull something like that off for what is now the catering budget of many TV shows, it was your entire budget.
Yes.
It's just phenomenal.
That's not even coming close. That's like the coffee budget. That's not even the donut. It's not even the donut part of the budget. And even, you know, if you're figuring, you know, $5 to the pound and, you know, I mean, that's like, it's like doing something for $20,000. I mean, that's impossible. You can't.
Yeah.
Josh hasn't even done that.
No, not yet.
Not yet.
But Club Springs Eternal.
Well, why not? Why not? That's why. You know, we keep going at least until one can't, and that's what I'm doing. You know, there's a time and a place, and as far as I'm concerned, I've still got the juices, and I just need to get the opportunity to do it.
But not a bad track record, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we were, you know, I've got your IMDb up here, and, you know, looking at it, I just, I've seen all of these movies. You know, I particularly love Onassis.
Plus, you work with Olivier. I've seen Don Gielgud here.
Yeah.
One of my favorites, Gene Wilder, of course.
Clocks Are Fortune is just amazing. It's an amazing film. I love that film.
Not a bad day at the track, my friend.
No, it's not. I am happy to say. I'm glad you appreciate it.
I just have to say, you know, Netflix Juarez, okay? one of the things that I like to do is, you know, see people's other work, and obviously I've seen everything Tom Baker's ever been in, but, you know, Clocks Are Fortune is just, it is wonderful. I'm such waiting for film. Melody to arrive.
Melody's now apparently has been put on DVD.
Yes.
It is, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's, I remember seeing it. It's really wonderful, but you should really explore because, I really love Juarez's work, and it's worthwhile catching up and mm-hmm. then waiting for new things to come as well and seeing them when they come out and not just getting fixated on the Who.
We'll come back more with legendary director Juarez Hussein right after these important messages.
Hi, this is Juarez Hussein. Thank you for listening to Doctor Who Podshock.
Hey, this Saturday, the 21st of August, 2010, we're coming together once again for our seasonal meetups on Second Life, the virtual environment, which you can come together no matter where you are, where you happen to live, no barriers, as long as you have broadband internet connection and a fairly modern computer, you can join in for free. Once again, it's our seasonal meetup, and this time we're celebrating 5 years. 5 years, ladies and gentlemen, of Doctor Who Podshock. So come and join us on Second Life this Saturday, in the Doctor Who experience in the land of Katrina on Second Life. For more information and for a intro video, visit our website, thegallifreyanembassy.org or podshock.net, and you can see an article about it on the front page. So check it out. It's Doctor Who Podshock and the Gallifreyan Embassy Second Life Meetup, the 21st of August 2010, this Saturday, coming up. Depending on when you're listening to this podcast, you could happened last Saturday or several Saturdays ago. But if you did miss it, fear not, we'll be doing it again. We do it seasonally. We'll be doing it again in November, celebrating the anniversary of Doctor Who itself. If you've been to one of our meetups on Second Life, you know that Victor usually gives a TARDIS tour to Doctor Who themed areas on Second Life. And then we have our party, which consists of a live DJ with music, dancing, and if you don't worry, if you can't dance, there's a script for that. And it will make your avatar dance. So it's pretty cool. And this year we may be doing something more. We may be recording an episode. We also have an aftershock party, after party. So check it out. This Saturday, the 21st, it starts at 1 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time or Second Life Time. Adjust times to your time zone. For more information, go to thegallifreyanembassy.org or podshock.net. It's currently on the front page after Saturday. It may slip off, so if you're listening to this before Saturday the 21st, it will be on the front page. Check it out. Hope to see you there. And if you can't meet us there, you might want to meet other Doctor Who fans and other sci-fi and fantasy fans at Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy. They have stores in Austin and San Antonio, Texas. They also have a new store now in Bellevue, Washington. Not only can you meet up there, you can get some Doctor Who goodies there as well, because they sell Doctor Who action figures, CDs, comics, and more. They also sell other stuff like board games, role-playing games, card games, graphic novels, Magna, and much, much more. Check them out at their website at dlayer.net. That's D as in dragon, layer.net. And they're also celebrating an anniversary. It's their 24th anniversary, so please wish them a happy anniversary on behalf of Doctor Who Podshock. Once again, you can visit them in person in Austin or San Antonio, Texas, or in Bellevue, Washington, or visit them on their website at dlayer.net. That's D as in dragon, layer.net. Or simply give them a call at 512-454-2399. That's 512-454-2399. Dragon's Lair Comics and Fantasy. If you're enjoying this episode of Doctor Who Podshock, interviewing the legendary first director ever of Doctor Who, Juarez Hussein, this episode was made possible in part by ongoing support of Doctor Who Podshock supporting subscribers. If you would like this show to continue, please consider becoming a Podshock supporting subscriber. For a low monthly subscription fee as a show of support, not only will you be helping us continue and grow the show, but you also get extra content as well. To become a Podshock supporting subscriber, go to thegallifreyanembassy.org or podshock.net and click on the Podshock supporting subscriber banner on the top. If you are already a Podshock supporting subscriber, thank you so much for your continued support. It does make a huge difference. And now let's get back to our talk with legendary first director of Doctor Who, Waris Hussein.
I have a couple of very specific Doctor Who questions, if I could, for the hardcore fan. First, is it true that there were fleas on an unearthly child and with the caveman costumes?
You know, it wasn't like there was an infestation. I think there were like a couple of costumes, but I don't think it was like everybody was running around scratching themselves. So that's a bit of
exaggeration.
An exaggeration, yes.
In Marco Polo, mm-hmm. in the middle there, another director took over for, I think it's part four out of the 7-part story, yeah. where you hadn't done a week and then you came back to finish up the story. And yeah. I was wondering if you could kind of put us in the picture of how something like that happened.
It's because the schedule was so tight, and the fact was I could not have fulfilled all the necessary requirements. That's what happened. And I think it was because I was filming some of the stuff, you know, the fight sequences between what was Tagana, the character played mm-hmm. by Darren Nesbitt. We were filming at Ealing Studios. And it was one of those times where they actually allowed us to do a film of a fight. And we were, I think it was to do with the fact that it was too much on my plate.
Yeah.
And Verity just realized that you can't ask somebody. Don't forget, this was endless. It was 7 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And, all shot out of sequence and stuff. So
wow.
In a sense, yeah. it was overwhelming and one did it.
Your script supervisor had her work cut out for her.
Absolutely.
Him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how close a relationship then do you have with someone else who's coming to step in? I mean, is there a lot of discussion? You know, is he working really hand in hand with what you're doing to fulfill the overall vision of the story?
To be honest with you, I do not recall having had any conversations with the person coming in. This sort of thing just was expected. I think what he probably did was to watch what I'd done and try to fix it in his own mind so that he didn't have mm-hmm. any problems. I've had to do this subsequently on actually a feature film, which I stepped into a point where they'd been shooting for 2 weeks mm-hmm. and they fired the director, and I had to pick up on a Friday the script and start shooting on the following Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And they'd got 2 weeks of shooting, and they couldn't afford to go back on it because of the budget requirements, and there were crowd scenes. Mm-hmm. And it was a period piece. So I had to then look at the guy's work and see how I could meld in with his style without getting totally slavish to something I wasn't going to be able to do.
Mm.
But if you look at the movie, you're never going to be aware
yeah.
of what he did and what I did. It's that film over there, the one with Jean Marais.
Summer Heaven, yeah. Joan Plowright, yeah. Wow.
Mm-hmm. But that was, I had to take that over over a weekend.
Wow.
It was without any preparation. So I think, you know, in these events, you don't sit down. Obviously, in this case of Doctor Who, it wasn't an emergency and no one was being fired. But I think right. he was watching what we were doing, and he just picked up from where we, you know, picked up and ran at the ball.
In that story, in Marco Polo, the character of Marco Polo, in something that's an oddity amongst 40-something years of Doctor Who, he is narrating the story, and it's a very interesting technique because he really sets up, he paints a picture verbally by reading from his diary.
Yeah.
And that's a neat way, budget-wise, of putting the audience in the picture,
yes.
without actually having to show a lot. And it, you know, he's reading, it's his words. But who comes up with something like that? Is that something the writer puts to page? Is that something that...
John Lucarotti, you've got to give him full marks because he did a lot of research. And obviously we could not show what he was talking about. And we did the usual Hollywood thing of the map and the route, you know, going across while the narration takes place. He made that suggestion because he said, look, we're really trying to put an enormous amount of stuff into a pint pot. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to be able to achieve it without looking silly. So what we're trying to do is put things into practicality. And if you want to just then tell the audience what they should know simply by telling them to what not to expect, and then you give them the unexpected, which is like the way stations and the people.
Yeah.
I can tell you a funny story about not the fleas, but on Marco Polo, I always like a bit of eccentricity, and one of the characters was supposed to be a quirky character, and I said to Verity, I think he should be accompanied by a dwarf. She said, that is very un-PC. You cannot call him a dwarf. So I said, all right, I'm not mean, I just mean a small person. And she said, why do you want us to do this? And I said, well, because I think it'd be quite fun. And she said, well, I don't want it done at the expense of making fun of a little person. And she was right. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, the reason I'm choosing this is because in very famous paintings by Velázquez and people, mm-hmm. you have these little people standing around. And I just think this quiet little person following him around is like so quirky. So she said, well, I'm really not happy with there's something about it that would make. And she was right. Mm-hmm. But she supported me in my thinking. And I ended up suggesting a spider monkey. One of these tiny little things that you can put on your shoulder.
Yeah, yeah.
So the character could walk around with the spider monkey. And so that was approved of, apart from having to find one. Mm-hmm. And we did find one. But this is the funny story. During a take, it suddenly shat all over. And forget the fleas. The stench was unbelievable. It filled the whole studio.
Oh, my goodness.
The actor nearly passed out because it was on his shoulder. His costumes. I mean, there was chaos. Everything had to be grinding halt. We had to take Tuti Lemkov was the actor. He was a wonderful character, very eccentric. He was actually an acrobat and did, you know, he probably qualified for the Cirque du Soleil now.
Yeah. But, at one of the way stations. He was in one of the way stations?
Yes. Mm-hmm. With a patch on one eye. He had a patch on one eye and a monkey on his shoulder.
Did it happen on camera or...?
What this? Yes,
on camera?
But we had to stop and the cleaning had to be done and consternation and we're falling behind schedule and what do we do with the costume and the stench and
this was before about Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes, indeed.
Sure, they had that problem.
Did the conversation? Did a conversation with Verity ever happen where you said, see, if you just would have gone with the little person, none of this would have happened.
I have a quick question, getting back to Unearthly Child.
Yes.
You were talking about William Hartnell's attitude toward coming in and doing this kind of thing and what you had to do to get him to do it. So then when it was time to reshoot the whole thing, how did you get him to do it? Did you buy him lunch again or?
No. He was very easy.
On board by that point.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the thing about Bill was you'd come in and say, you know what? It was okay, but we can do it better.
Yeah.
That was always what got to him, you know. We can do it better. Oh, okay.
Perfect.
It seems when you watch the version of Unearthly Child that went to air, the second version, it has a polish to it and a flow to it, perhaps because you had more than a rehearsal. You had a full-on mounting of the story. So there were little details that were probably worked out because you went full-on with it.
Right. interestingly enough, I've always been embarrassed by the fact that they also made available the pilot to people. And I said, this should never have been made available because, it's, you know, people have seen it now. And I squirm every time I think of all the things that went wrong on it. And then the second one that we had that chance to do, it was interesting because Stephen Moffat, there was a screening at BAFTA of the final episode of the current series. Mm-hmm. And I was there and... you know, it was very nice because he introduced me at the end. He said, I'm happy to say that Waris Hussein is in the audience. And the entire audience applauded at BAFTA, which was lovely. But he then said, I urge all of you to see the first episode because of what they achieved. Mm-hmm. With what they had. And I think that was a great tribute. He said there's a lot of tension in it. Now, I don't see it as that. If somebody like that says something, I'm very happy. But for me, mm-hmm. I don't see what it is that created that, except that it's
there's
there,
a lot to appreciate, you know? in that one. I mean, I love both, you know, both versions, but there's certain things in the first one which well, you couldn't do in the second one because, to my understanding, the sets were the junkyard sets were gone. They had to kind of redo that for the remount. And I guess some of the, like, in the first one there's a scene where Barbara and Ian explore the junkyard a little bit more, and you see a clown face, and the lighting in that mm-hmm. was really, I have to say, the Unearthly Child is very cinematic, and I think what you did was incredible with, you know, doing that cinema verite thing in the junkyard, and you had these huge cameras to deal with, so you did the best that you could with what you had there, but...
And creating fog.
Yeah. And then in London. Years later now with Battlestar Galactica, they do that same thing, try to do that handheld, you know, style of camera work, but you did it first with Doctor Who there.
Yeah, and to back up things that were lost from the very first one that didn't make it to the reshoot, how about the Rorschach painting that when we meet Susan, that she starts connecting the dots to kind of sell the fact that she's mm-hmm. different and alien? Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought that was incredible. That should have made it into the next one.
It should have.
There's a lot of...
There was the things that were lost from the original. It's interesting. I'm not sure, and I cannot remember why we didn't incorporate some of the stuff, mm-hmm. but I think it may have been to do with the pacing or something. I'm not sure.
And, you know, I was talking, I know Graham Harper as well. I don't know if you know Graham Harper. He also had directed things.
Yes.
And one of the things that we are talking about and that I really noticed in this is how fluid the camera is. And knowing, I mean, I did a little three camera stuff at school, and those things were, you know, they were from I Love Lucy.
Monsters.
So they were, you know, but still they were so impossible to move. And it's always moving. And that's what makes it interesting. And TV tends to be so boring. And especially when you have no time and no money, you end up with like a master shot, and that's all you can do, just everyone standing around, but you're zooming in and panning through, and it's just fabulous to watch. And I did see that first. I didn't realize there were two because I don't know a lot of this stuff, but I thought it was phenomenal. And, you know, things did change, but there's nothing to be ashamed of. It's a
yes, and you know, when it comes to that with the first and the second pilot, is that yes, the first one is a template, you know, there are mistakes there or things that you could wish you could do better. But when you compare them side by side, you realize even more what a masterpiece the final product is.
Well, that's kind of you to say.
No, honestly, it is a piece of television history. And when the grand book of television is written, mm-hmm. when they write about that iconic show, Doctor Who, they have to go to the first episode. You have to point to the pilot. You have to see how it started. And if it would have sucked, it would have been over.
True.
Well, it would have fallen on its face.
Can I say that I have to pay tribute to the fact that I've always been a film buff. My ambition was to come to L.A. I mean, I never thought I'd end up here anyway. Mm-hmm. But I used to watch Hollywood movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at the iconic black and white movies, which still stand up today, the camera movements in them, the mm-hmm. fact that people, I mean, I used to study them, and I thought, God, if only I could get my hands on something like this. So when you got something like that and you don't really have anything to lose, you've got everything to gain.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because the fact is, we started with nothing.
Was it a product of your age at that time that you didn't realize that you weren't supposed to do something, or that there was never a thing like, well, I know I can't pull that off?
Yes. Of course, it's a form of rebellion, too. It's a form of arrogance, youthful arrogance. Mm-hmm. I guess now I'd be scared to do some of the things I was sort of getting myself into. You know, at that time, you had nothing to lose except to prove that you could do it. Mm. And I felt that that was... But I had a support system. You can't do it on your own. Mm-hmm. I think when directors stand up there and take all the praise, it's really horrible because they shouldn't. They're supported by a system. I was supported by Sidney Newman, who, by the way, to this day never gets a credit on those shows.
He's not even listed in the credits.
It should be created by Sidney Newman, mm-hmm. which is what it was. And I've mentioned this a number of times. They never do anything about it. In one of the episodes with David
Tennant, parents were
yes,
human.
The parents were Verity, Sidney and Verity.
Yeah.
But you know, that's not enough. Anyway, I was supported by Sidney, and I was supported by Verity. And I believe in the producer-director relationship. It's not always worked. I've worked with some producers I could kill. But that's only because we're dealing with egos.
Yeah.
You know? And there's some people who... You see, I respect anybody who knows what they're doing. If they tell me, look, you can't do this, and give me a good enough reason, I'm the first one to say, okay. But if they just say, you can't do this, and there's no reason for it, mm-hmm. I'll never forget I did an NBC movie here. And in those days, I was doing a lot of movies of the week. And it was a scene where a young girl is behind a fence, and it's a wire fence, mm-hmm. and she's on one side, and on the other side is her, I think it's her dad. Anyway, the sun hit her face, and her face is laced with the shadows of fence. The mm-hmm. Fence. And I thought, this is fabulous. We didn't even have to light it.
Yeah.
The next thing is I get a note. We can't have those lines over that kid's face. Why not? Because it gets in the way of what's being said.
What?
I said, this has to be the worst note I've ever had. And the executive, because she needed to prove her power, you know, we had to start trying to get rid of these lines off the face electronically.
Oh. Jesus.
Because we couldn't go back to shoot. You know, you finish on a location, you can't go back there just to get rid of this. So what I'm saying is when that kind of edict comes through, you want to go and kill someone. But when you got somebody giving you a reasonable answer, mm-hmm. then you obviously listen to it. And I don't believe in this whole thing of, when it says so-and-so's film, a film by. I think a film mm-hmm. by is actually more interesting than so-and-so's film. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A film by makes sense. But this credit stuff and all the things that go into ego stuff, I mean, I personally am not one of those people. I mean, I've been given credit, but never, it's not a Waris Hussein film. Because it's not. You've got 100 people behind you.
Yeah.
And that's the way I think. And that was my television traineeship from the way... From the days I did Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And it still lasts with you, you know? So whether you're doing Doctor Who or the most expensive movie ever, you've got to bear that in mind. But, you know, that's me.
Yeah, now I feel the same way with that, you know, a film bomb or a such and such film. You know, it's a collective, collaborative thing. So unless you did everything yourself, then you can say it's a such and such film.
Well, if the Doctor's parents were Verity and Sidney, then... Mm. The Doctor's uncle, his favorite uncle, his godfather, perhaps, would be his Uncle Waris. So
yes.
We want to thank you so much. Sorry. Well, go ahead. You were saying.
No, I'm very happy to be called an uncle.
Before we depart, I just wanted to ask one other Doctor Who related question was, you had mentioned that it was your decision to make the TARDIS interior white to give that expansive feel to it, and Verity Lambert has credited you for finding Carol Ann Ford for the role of Susan, and you had mentioned how you must feel right now, you know, being part of the original, you know, the first episode that went out, and how it's let at that time it was, you know, set for 1 year. No one could imagine it lasting, you know, that you'll be here 40 years, some odd years later talking about it. Over the years, has there been anything that you might have spotted in the show that said, oh, well, that was actually my idea? Or was there any other elements other than maybe the TARDIS interior being white and casting Carol Ann or finding, was there any other decisions that you had made that that lingered onto the show that became iconic?
I wish I could say that, but I don't think that's the case. I can't really point to anything and say that was something that I originated and it still exists. I can't really claim any of that.
Well, you know, I would say, and I was listening to the commentary too, just the fact that you cast really good actors, you know, and started that process. I'm sure it was collaborative, but I think the acting in Doctor Who, and not all of it, but in most of it, is just so much better than a show of like an equal budget would be here necessarily. And I just, you know, I think, you know, obviously you inspired that and were able to attract the talent and keep.
Well, I would say that Carol Ann, for instance, we were looking for a girl who would somehow look kind of strange and yet not. And in those days, the BBC, everything used to be shot in the studios, and we used to, there was an observation room that you could go and watch a show being lined up and hear the AD on the floor talking to the director up there and watch what's going on the floor. And I happened to be watching a show, it was a drama being lined up, and there was this young girl standing around waiting on camera to deal with whatever was happening in the scene. And I looked at her and I thought, we haven't seen anybody that we kind of are interested in at the moment. And I called Verity up. She was in the office upstairs. And I said, Verity, come down here. Have a look at this girl. I don't know what she's like or anything, but she's on camera right now. So she came down. We looked at the monitor, and there was Carol Ann. And that's how it happened. We called her in, and that's how she got cast. It was purely on instinct and by chance that I happened to be watching that day. So these things happen, don't they?
Oh, yeah, there is another one right there. Well, it means something you contributed to.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I will claim the same thing happened with another actor who since then become very famous. But I don't know whether we should go into this area of me discovering people. The same thing happened with Tom Conti. When I was casting for a series called The Glittering Prizes, and this is another story, because it was written by Freddie Raphael, and who's a great writer. But it was based on his own experiences at Cambridge, and he wrote this kind of upper middle class Jewish boy, and we couldn't find anybody because in those days upper middle class Jewish boys didn't go into acting.
Sure.
They went into doctoring, medicine, law, or whatever. So we're trying to find somebody, and I'm talking to a very good friend of mine, having lunch, and I said, you know, we're finding it so difficult. And she said, she was doing Madame Bovary at the time.
Oh, right, yeah.
Francesca Annis. And she said to me, why don't you come and look in the studio? There's a guy playing my husband. So, sure enough, in observation room, watched the show being lined up, and there's Tom on camera. And I called up, my producer was then Mark Shivers. I said, Mark, come and look at this guy. And he comes down and he says, well, who is this? I said, it's Tom Conti. He's very well known on stage. But he hadn't done anything on TV, really. Anyway, that's how we sent him the script. He turned out to be not Jewish. He turned out Scottish.
Italian. Yeah.
And the funny thing is we have scenes in the film on a Friday night, and I had cast two parents. And they were both Jewish, but none of them knew what to do. There's Friday nights there. And I said, oh, geez, we've got to get somebody into it. Anyway, that was another story. But Tom read the scripts, and I'm sitting in Mark's office, phone call, Tom Conti, if you don't give me this part, I'm going to come to the gates of BBC and commit harakiri. And look what happened to him.
We are big Tom Conti.
We were just talking about him, Amy.
Yes, as a matter of fact.
So that's my Tom Conti story.
It's also beyond just casting in a show, as an example with Doctor Who. There's chemistry amongst the actors as well, because that's something that it either happens or it doesn't happen. And so I'm always curious to know what's the formula? Like, what's the secret to casting and creating chemistry? Is it down to skill, or is it something that just happens?
No, I think a lot of that, first of all, actors, unless they happen to be totally untalented, are very aware of why they are there. They may come in with their own ideas, they may not have the right approach to the part. But the fact is, it's up to the director to create an atmosphere. I've been involved with actors who absolutely are so full of themselves that it's very hard. But the point is, you've got to lay a track for them to follow. If you just come in and mumble stuff and don't have a point of view, they will then take advantage of it. I've never really, apart from the two major stars who I work with, who gave me a hard time because they were having a terrible time amongst themselves, most actors are anxious to get it right. But they also need to be told where to go or how to go, which direction. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a tendency, and I don't want to name names. I've watched a couple of directors work. And their insecurity means that they go into 14 takes on a setup in the hope that they'll get a performance. No. Well, that's not the way to do it. But if you haven't got a good actor on your hands, I don't think the best director in the world is going to survive. Because the worst, you know, that's the name of the game. I am always careful when I'm casting to be very... When I first came to L.A., I was casting for Quacks of Fortune. And we were in New York. And I was aware of the first time in my life, because at the BBC we worked in a different way, and certainly in Britain, the casting session was that we were in a hotel room and these people were lining up. And I was given, according to the people arranging the situation, 5 minutes per person. Wow, now, I know there's a time factor involved, but I'm also aware that some of these people had come a long way. They prepared themselves to be interviewed, and 5 minutes sometimes are not enough. So when you're saying, you're suddenly telling them what the story is about, and at one point, I think the AD said to me, "Warris, you've got to get moving on this. We're falling behind. This is only a cattle call." And it's the first time I'd heard that phrase. I'd never heard of cattle call. And I got really upset. I said, "But these aren't cattle.
Yeah.
These are human beings, and they're shit scared. Most of them have probably stayed up all night.
Yeah.
Nervous about it.
And they're, you know, so, and that's because very early on, I had the experience of acting very briefly, and I know what it's like.
I apologize for ADs everywhere.
I said that with apprehension, looking in your direction.
No worries, no worries.
You know, I think it's a very American versus British attitude towards that. I think that there's a complete lack of respect for actors here. You know, having been...
Background, especially.
But, you know, having started that way and people say, "Oh, they're making so much money." Well, they're not, because they don't work as much as we do, and that there's a point to that. And they do have to go off and prepare, and they have to think about it a lot. And yes, they get a trailer to lie down in, but everyone, they have a really bad attitude. And, you know, actors are great. I love actors. And I just think in England, there's a little more respect.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're not, but more of the time, it's not as a cattle call. I've done casting in London. My casting director, one of my best friends, is British. And it was the first time I ever did casting for the movie that Sarah Douglas was in. And I just was like, wow, this is so much nicer. It's not as pressured. And everyone has like 15 or 20 minutes. It's exactly the same thing. Like, wow, that's a lot of time. But it wasn't. It was just enough time. But I've been trained that way. So you're absolutely right about that. It's awful. And it does, you know, it does put people, I mean, it doesn't put anyone at their ease, and it's a very stressful situation.
But it is.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to...
But the reality is that we're all nervous anyway.
Yeah.
We hide our nerves by trying not to be. But the fact is, most people coming into audition are shaking in their shoes. Mm-hmm. And it's a horrible experience because a lot of them are going to be rejected.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of being quite, trying to be human about it,
mm-hmm.
And not impersonal.
I was really curious about this because it's an Irish movie with two American leads, one of whom is doing an Irish accent is Gene Wilder,
yes.
And Margot Kidder. And I just was, you know, I just thought that was sort of interesting. I mean, you do that to bring the money to the project or whatever.
Well, but first of all, let me tell you again, she'd only done one other film. She'd done a film called Gaily Gaily.
Yeah.
She'd not done anything.
So 92 in the Shade was after that.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Margot Kidder was nothing. Nobody. She walked in, and the reason she got the part is that at the last minute she came in and she said, I don't know what this is about. I really don't know. And I don't know whether I should be here at all. And I just fell on my face coming in and lost my shoe. She was going into this whole crazy thing about why she happened to be there. And we all like, this is, and this girl is absolutely amazing. She's not fazed by any of us. She's not running away. She's not anxious to get the part. And that's why she got it, because she had that kind of strange ability to just be herself.
And act without shoes.
And act without shoes. Yeah. she had no technique. When we got on set, I had a very traditional script supervisor, one of the best. She worked with people like Joe Losey and Schlesinger and everybody. She did it to me as a favor, because my very first movie I ever did was with Sandy Dennis, who, by the way, also had to play English. That's another interesting thing, because, you know, she was very quirky as an actress. Mm-hmm. She stopped in mid-sentence and stuttered and said a line. Well, in America, that was all after, though.
Oh, really?
This was a movie that was called A Touch of Love, or Thank You All Very Much, it was called. Mm-hmm. It was my first picture with Ian McKellen in his first picture. Oh, I can talk about a lot of first pictures. Anyway, the point was, the time I did that with Sandy, she's supposed to be playing a middle-class English socialist brought-up girl. Wow. So she comes to... Without her, we couldn't have got the money.
Yeah.
At that time, she was very hot because she was nominated for Tonys. I think she had done Virginia Woolf. Yeah. I mean, she was very high. Mm-hmm. So she agreed to do this part because she loved the movie. It's about an unmarried girl in London who decides to bring up a child without a man, which in those days was, you know, quite radical. Upper middle class English girl, and she's coming in getting her lessons, but she'd go into a stutter mode where she'd get away with it in America because that's way of acting. But you, no English girl does that. And I would have to say, Sandy, we just can't do that. You have stuttered your way through this speech. Please, now, please just listen to what you're doing. And she was actually terrific. She listened, and we got on with it. I don't know how we got on to this. Was it to do with acting?
Yeah, we're talking about Americans doing Americans. Accents.
So Jean, right.
Yeah.
Jean, in all fairness, tried very hard to get it right, and I think he succeeded.
Yeah.
Margot was totally inexperienced. She came on set, and the first day shoot, Pam Davis looked at her. She had to walk with Jean, who was trundling this part, and she... she would do whatever she wanted. Nothing matched. So, and of course, Pam was a stickler for matching. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, people don't bother that much. But in those days, it was like, you use your left hand for this and your right hand for that when you picked up the cup and all that kind of stuff.
By the way, real quick, matching. We should talk about what matching means.
Oh, do you have that in English?
Would you like
to... No, go ahead, because I have another question about stuttering.
What happens is, you make multiple takes of a scene, and the actors, if they don't more or less match where they were sitting or how they were moving or if they had a cup in their hand or not, it's hard to cut because you'll use pieces from different takes.
Exactly.
And if you don't match, then let me tell you John Favreau stories. But anyway, moving on, that's what matching means.
So
that's
some actors will pick up a cup so they'll get more coverage on themselves because they know exactly what they're doing. They want to... Have you seen that?
Exactly, yes.
Oh, yeah.
But back to, even the stuttering thing made me think of back to Doctor Who, of course. William Hartnell is pretty famous for... let's say, flubbing a line or two, because they would leave those in there. Did you have to wrestle with that a lot with his first outing?
No, interestingly enough, we didn't. In fact, whenever he was tending to do that, he used it in a performance, like somebody who's about to be distracted or his mind is going in three different directions. So he'd use that, and we'd keep it.
And they continue to keep it throughout his run.
Well, it added to his eccentricity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, added to it.
And it made it seem natural. Mm-hmm. It made him seem very real.
That he was thinking on the spot.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I can drop another name, a lady who did that not often. I was directing Betty Davis, to name a few, but she was wonderful. And there would be a moment, then suddenly there'd be a long pause, and then she'd continue. And I'd then say, I'm afraid we're going to have to do that again, Miss Davis, because, oh, why? Because there was a very long pause. Well, she says, there are two ways of dealing with that. You cut away... or you use it as a thought process. And I said, yes, Miss Davis, but thought process can be very naked on and tell against you rather than for you. Oh, in that case, we'll do it again.
Nice save.
Yeah.
Nice save.
Well done.
But that's how you deal with it, you know? You go along with it. You don't suddenly say, well, that was a screwed up thing, and you screwed that up because you pause in the middle. You have to deal with it. It's diplomacy.
Well, it's also directing.
I'm writing that down, actually.
It's directing because I know a lot of directors, they don't understand how to... They're cattle, they're chess pieces. The actors aren't that. They're people, and they have feelings, and they're sensitive.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Dated one for 9 years, and you know. So, but I think you really know how to handle that, and that's a very good skill. About Bette Davis, I don't know.
Wow,
that's pretty scary. Not as scary as the other two people, but you know, but probably close.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I know we're running out of time. We've taken up more time than we thought we would, and you're very generous with it, by the way.
Thank you
very much for joining us on Doctor Who Podshock. And I know you're out in L.A. We come out to L.A. in February every year for the big Doctor Who convention. So at some point, perhaps if you're in L.A. at that time, we have to do lunch and meet face-to-face. It's such a wonderful experience to have a chance to talk with you and hear your recollections about the very beginnings of our favorite show.
Well, if I'm here, I'd love to be here. I know you people come out here, don't you?
Every February, yeah. There's a
yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know whether I'll be here or not, but I'd love to be a part of it if it's around. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
We can also put you in touch with the right people, so no worries.
We hook you up.
Yeah, that's what we do.
All right. So for myself, Ken Deep and Louis Trapani, yes, and in L.A., Amy and Joshua, we want to thank Waris Hussein, the legendary director of An Unearthly Child, and Marco Polo,
among many other projects.
Very beginnings of Doctor Who history. Thank you very much for joining us today on an incredible episode of Doctor Who Podshock. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wow, that was really fantastic. Once again, we thank Waris Hussein for taking so much time out with us for this interview. We also thank Joshua Lou Friedman and Amy Krell, both our West Coast correspondents, for helping put together this interview. Such a great interview covering Doctor Who, old and new. And you know what? Speaking of Doctor Who new, since we covered Doctor Who of old, let's go to some newest material now with our recommendation for Audible.com. As you probably already know, if you're listening to this show, that Audible.com is the leading provider of digital audiobooks. They have over 75,000 titles to choose from, every genre, be it thrillers, business, history, science fiction, and fantasy. They have it covered. Audible content is compatible with iPods, iPhones, MP3 players, and over 500 devices for listening anytime, anywhere, just like this podcast. And for you, listeners of Doctor Who Podshock, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a 14-day trial to check out their service. How cool is that? To download your free audiobook today, simply go to audiblepodcast.com/arttrap. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/arttrap, ARTTRAP, for your free audiobook. And as always, what we try to do is make a suggestion for a free download, if you like. And this time we're going to the latest offerings in the realm of Doctor Who. And this is Doctor Who, The Runaway Train. This was written specially for audio by Ali Smith. And it's read by none other than Matt Smith. Yes, Matt Smith, the Doctor, reads this exclusive audio story featuring the 11th Doctor and Amy. Arriving on Earth in the midst of the American Civil War, the Doctor and Amy must get a posse together to help them retrieve an alien artifact that has fallen into the clutches of the Confederate Army. Let's hear a little bit from that right now.
Slowly. Doctor, the man in the overalls, stepped forward. The Doctor held up a hand. I'm sorry, do I know you? He scoured the disparate group, his smooth face and pale skin a sharp contrast to the rugged features that confronted him. Vin raised an eyebrow and glanced to the soldier at his right. The railroad man looked bemused. I hope this is a joke, Doctor. It's me, Hilario. You asked me to come. I did? The Doctor scratched his cheek, then resolved himself. Well, if it did, it did. Pleased to meet you all. He grabbed Hilario's limp hand with both of his and pumped it warmly, striding over to offer the same courtesy to the rest of the band. All the while, his eyes darted around, searching for some clues as to the nature of this peculiar welcome party. He spotted the stripes on the soldier's tattered uniform, or rather, a lack of them. Ah, Private. He flapped his hand about in the hope that it would convey the idea of a name being on the tip of his tongue. Bernardo, sir. The private stepped forward. Though I ain't no private anymore, I told you that in the saloon about 3 weeks back. There was a pause as the doctor absorbed the information. And that's a local saloon? He queried at last. Bernardo laughed. No, sir. It weren't in Ennis. A good 2 days' travel on the stage. He fumbled with his cap for a second. I can't afford no horse, you see. So you didn't all come together? No, doctor, none of us have seen each other before in our lives. Ben slowly plucked the unlit cigar he'd been chewing from his mouth and carried on. None of us have seen each other before, and none of us ever would have if you hadn't called us here. His tone sharpened. Now, I didn't come here for meet and greet. I came here because you offered us a job. The outlaw shoved his face into the doctor's, the only man with his gun still drawn. The doctor felt cold metal pushing at his ribcage. A job, he continued, with a rather large reward, as I recall. And I think I recall right, as I wouldn't have trekked halfway across Texas to be here if there weren't something. He rolled the word around his tongue. Substantial in it for me. I see, said the doctor, somewhat at a loss for words. He tugged his collar. So what reward have we offered them? A girl's voice emerged from the interior of the TARDIS, followed shortly after by its owner, Amy Pond. The doctor turned as if to reply, but stopped short at the sight of her. Man, if she ain't as beautiful as the first day I laid eyes on her, Hilary murmured. Dressed in a white blouse and sky-blue silk skirt, all ruffles and gatherings, her fiery hair loosely braided over one shoulder, Amy would have blended perfectly with the ladies of class at a 19th-century garden party. But sadly, her present company was rather less dignified. I'm sorry I was getting changed, she smiled broadly. Thought I'd make an effort. She stepped across to join the doctor. So, she repeated, stumbling slightly, as the heel of her shoe lodged in between the roughly hewn planks of the platform. What reward? Bernardo pulled his cap back on and gave Vin a look of admonishment. Well, I ain't the type to be so quick to talk about business, especially as being in the company of a young lady such as yourself is reward enough for the likes of me. Save it, Amy snapped. But both you and the doctor did promise myself, and I presume my fellow recruits here, a modest plot of farmland in return for our troubles. By which I mean trouble of aiding in the transport of your, goods.
Hey, that's fantastic. I love Matt Smith with those accents. That's fantastic. Remember, to download your free audiobook today, simply go to audiblepodcast.com/arttrap. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/arttrap, ARTTRAP, for your free audiobook. If you didn't catch the URL, don't worry. It's on our website, thegallifreyanembassy.org or podshock.net, and look for the Audible banner there and click on it. You know what's also on our website? There's also a link for a special offer from Netflix. Now, Amy had mentioned Netflix earlier in the interview to use to find Warren Hussein's catalog of movies. And not only can you find his catalog of movies, but you'll find Doctor Who, The Unearthly Child there as well. So if you haven't seen the very first episode of Doctor Who, now is your chance. You can use Netflix to find it. Netflix is the world's largest subscription service streaming movies and TV episodes over the internet and sending DVDs by mail, all for only $8.99 a month. You could try them free at this special offer. Again, you'll find a link to this offer on our website, GallifreyAnembassy.org or Podshock.net, or you can also go to arttrap.com/Netflix. And for all things Doctor Who, it's all going on our website, TheGallifreyAnembassy.org or Podshock.net. Keep on top of Doctor Who news and discussions by going to our website in between Doctor Who Podshock episodes or even while listening to Doctor Who Podshock episodes, as long as you're not driving or doing anything else that you shouldn't be distracting yourself by going to our website while doing. You can also follow us all on Twitter, and that's available on our website too. Instead of going through all our Twitter addresses, simply go to thegallifreyanembassy.org or podshock.net, and on the left column sidebar there, you'll see a link to follow us on Twitter, and if you click on that link, it will give you all our Twitter addresses. So I think that's going to wrap things up for this episode, this special episode of Doctor Who Podshock. We hope you can join us next time. We have another special interview coming up. Well, all our interviews are special. So until next time, cheers, everyone.
Take care.
Cheers,
everyone.
Cheers.
Cheers.
That's a cheers I didn't give you last week.
You could do it twice then.
You have been listening to Doctor Who Podshock, presented by the fan-run Gallifreyanimacy.org. Doctor Who is owned and trademarked by the BBC. Doctor Who Podshock is not affiliated with the BBC in any way. Come back next time for another exciting and informative episode of Doctor Who Podshock. You can email us at feedback@podshock.net. Doctor Who Podshock theme music by Jeff Smith at thejeffsmith.com. This has been a production of Art Trap Productions and is presented to you by the Gallifreyan Embassy and has been made possible in part by supporting subscribers and donations from listeners like you.
We are wanderers in the fourth dimensions of space and time.